All right. So welcome everyone to the Canadian Rett Syndrome Communication Web Series. This is our second speaker, Kathy Howery, who will be joining us. Kathy, first I'd like to say thank you to all the provincial associations that have provided funding to provide these communication sessions to all of our families across Canada. So we have the, I'm just going to go in order, the Rett Syndrome Society of British Columbia, the Alberta Rett Syndrome Society, the Manitoba Association, Manitoba Rett Syndrome Association, and Saskatchewan Association, and the Ontario Rett Syndrome Association. Sorry, I'm very terrible with everybody's names, but everybody has all provided funding to make sure that these webinars are available to all of our families across Canada rather than doing small pieces in each province. So we have Kathy Howery with us today. Kathy received her PhD in special education from the University of Alberta in 2017. She is currently an educational consultant and a seasonal lecturer at several universities in Alberta. Her doctoral research drew up humoric phonology to seek understanding what is it like for young people with complex communication needs to speak with speech-generating devices. Kathy has presented at scores of educational conferences at both national and international levels, including International Society for Augmentative and Alternative Communication Conference, also known as ISAC, the Assistive Technology Industry Association Conference, and the Council for Exceptional Children Conference. Kathy has also presented her research in areas of CCN and the area of universal design of learning at numerous conferences in Alberta, British Columbia, and Quebec. So, and Kathy's going to talk to us today about what the device demands, lived experiences for users. So without further ado, I will invite Kathy to hop on and take over from here.
Right. This is what I said. I've got two screens and I have to figure out how to make them both work. I will always remember the frown of disapproval on the speech therapist's face as I failed one speech assessment after another. The therapist seemed particularly officious when she told Davina and me that the lip reading system we had fashioned on our own was inefficient. She assumed that no one could learn it and I would be restricted in communication if I did not acquire an artificial voice. You know, no one will understand you. You will be dependent on your wife and your mother-in-law. Don't you want to be independent? Don't you want to be independent? Those are the words of Dr. Albert Robillard, a professor of sociology who acquired motor neuron disease and, like many people with this condition, also lost the ability to speak intelligible, audible words. In his book, The Meaning of Disability, The Lived Experience of Paralysis, Dr. Robillard recounts his journey through his disease and perhaps a trained ethnographer might, with insights that can only come from the experience as lived through. Don't you want to be independent? Dr. Robillard lived in a time when speech-generating devices were just emerging as viable alternatives for people with complex communication needs. His book was published in 1999, and he speaks of trialing macaws and other simple speech-generating devices of the day. What he mostly speaks of is institutions of individualism, the value that Western society places on independent individuals and the belief that independence is good while dependence is somehow bad, and the widespread belief that every problem has a technological fix. As he says, he was told he would be made into a biological man. Yet through the book, what he holds on to is being a man, and what he persistently rails against is the demands of the device. In the years before speech-generating devices were created, the communication system that Dr. Robillard and his wife fashioned would have seemed wondrous and inventive. The fact that he was also able to have his doctoral students learn his speech system was more marvelous, as it has allowed him to go on with his work, not independently, mind you, but in a timely and, I shall say, collegial manner. But Dr. Robillard's experience with disability happened at a time where the new bright, shiny hope of augmentative and alternative communication devices, indeed the field of AAC itself, was emerging. And because these devices were available in the world, because they existed, there was already a demand for Dr. Robillard, a demand that they be used. Don't you want to be independent? Hi, as I've already been introduced, my name is Kathy Howery, and what I'm going to share with you today is some of the research that began when I undertook my PhD at the University of Alberta. And while my PhD is relatively new, my experience of speaking with and working with children and youth with complex communication needs goes back now some 35 years, actually some 40 years, gosh. I started in the field at a school for students with multiple disabilities, and I worked with marvelous technologies such as the Apple IIe computer and the adaptive firmware card and the most high-tech Zygo 16 and Zygo 100. If I could have imagined then the AAC devices that exist today, I am certain that I would have thought all of my students' communication challenges would be solved. As we gather here today, I'm sure that you will agree with me, or perhaps you won't, perhaps we will have some things to talk about, that we still have a long way to go. What I'm going to share with you today is part of a broader phenomenological study into what it's like to speak with or through a speech-generating device. During my doctoral program and since, but during my doctoral program particularly, I spent 5 years reading accounts of speech-generating device users, interviewing young people with physical disabilities who have used speech-generating devices in the context of classrooms and social activities, and being with these same people on a day-to-day basis. This being with, in phenomenology, is referred to as close observation. While prior to engaging in this research, I had been with young people who use AAC countless times at various points in my career, but it was always for a different purpose. I had never been with them just to watch, to learn, to understand. In the past, I was there to help, to intervene, to implement. During this study, I just watched and listened and watched. Phenomenology as a method investigates the lived experience of those who have experienced a certain phenomenon. In its simplest terms, it can be described as the study of lived experience. To engage in such a study, this is a tricky business, one needs to enter into or perhaps seek to embrace what they call a phenomenological attitude. And that attitude is one where you suspend presuppositions, past beliefs, and preconceptions about a phenomenon and instead become open to how the phenomenon shows itself. That was particularly difficult for me because I had lots of preconceived ideas about speech-generating devices, as you'll perhaps see as we go through this. Phenomenology is primarily a method of and for questioning rather than a method for answering or discovering or drawing determinate conclusions. The hope is that in this questioning, there exists the possibility and potentialities for experiencing openings, understandings, and insights, which might give us glances of the meaning of a phenomenon and eventually in its what it means for that person in its particularity and what it means generally for the society at large. Phenomenology is the study of the world as it is immediately experienced. In order to accomplish this, one must seek concrete lived experience descriptions, experiences as lived through. While this might seem a simple task, it is often not. In my study, for example, when I asked the young people to tell me about a time that they spoke with a speech generating device, they often would tell me, it's great. It helps me to speak to others. It helps me to communicate. While all of these reflections are most likely true, they are reflections upon the experience, not the actual experience itself. It is far easier to have someone recount what they think about something than to tell you about a concrete moment of living through the experience. This study draws upon a particular method of phenomenology, that being phenomenology of practice, is developed and articulated by Dr. Max Van Manen, my professor. A phenomenology of practice can be understood as an inquiry that addresses and serves the practices of professionals, as well as the common practices of everyday life, which is, I'm thinking, more relevant for you family members who are here with us today. My work is further informed by the writings and insights of phenomenologists whose writings explore human-technology relations. These scholars have shown that technological artifacts or things are not neutral intermediaries, but actively co-shape people's being in the world. Technological artifacts or things help to shape humans' actions, perceptions, and create new practices and new ways of living. The very presence of a technology in the world can create something beyond an invitation, much more akin to a demand. For example, in exploring what an ultrasound machine does, Peter Paul Verbeek suggests that by its very presence, it fundamentally shapes their experience of an unborn child. The mere availability of testing possibilities made us feel responsible for not testing and accepting the risks associated with that. Beyond an invitation to the womb, the ultrasound, it seems, created a demand, or at least a strong moral imperative to do so. It is with these insights and questions that arose as I watched and listened and read about the real experiences of speech generating device users that today's particular glimpse into their technologically mediated lives emerged. What by their very presence in the world do speech generated devices do? What do these devices afford people who cannot effectively communicate with their natural voices? And what is the meaning of these devices in their lives? Today, I'm going to share with you one part of the broader study, and that is looking at what the device demands. As Sarah Blackstone, a preeminent scholar in the field, points out, the most important voices are often the hardest to hear. It is my hope that by the careful and attentive listening using phenomenological methods, that I may bring the voices of device users out of their perhaps imposed silence and seek greater understanding of the meaning of the devices in their lives. So as I embarked upon this, and to give you a little background into where these anecdotes and stories came from, I read everything that I could find that had been written by people who had experienced speech generating devices have experienced speaking through a speech generating device. There's a couple more books that are added to this list, and this is often something that I get asked for at the end of this talk is, can you send me the list of those books? And it's a wonderful read if you're interested. I also looked in the AAC and assistive technology literature for lived experience descriptions. But my primary source of stories of lived experience were derived from speaking with participants in my study. They were all users of electronic, or what is often referred to today as high-tech speech generating devices, and were currently or had recently used these communication devices in a K-12 school setting. They were asked to share their experiences of using speech generating devices, particularly those that involved their memories of school. The young people in my study mostly had cerebral palsy, not all. There is one voice from a young woman who has Rett's that is also included in my talk today, which hopefully you won't be able to tell that from any other, but we'll see. All right. I gathered their stories through interview, face-to-face, which often took many hours, and virtually, which often took many days, and through being with them in their daily lives and documenting memories of augmented communication. I actually even went camping with a young girl and her family, and my own daughter didn't believe it when I told her where I was, because I don't do camping, but it was an interesting experience. And through electronic means, numerous text messages over a period of months, and in some cases, even years. What I now want to do is provide a glimpse into one of the aspects of speaking through a device, what the device demands.
Are we supposed to be hearing sound?
Oops, now you are. Now you're supposed to be hearing sound and it's not working. Ha ha ha, let me try this. Of course, why would it work today? I'm going to try it on. Oh, that just ruins everything. Fiddle. What it's supposed to do now is have electronic voice say those very words out loud. I don't know why it's not doing it. I'm just a minute. Give me a minute. Sorry. How about that for ruining the effect? Okay. Anyway, I will just continue on. I think. I can't even get my mouse back. Sorry, guys. So much for me and my fancy technological. I don't want to gather the windows. Do this for a minute. I don't know where my mouse went, just a minute. And if I don't have a mouse, I can't do it. All right. Oh, shoot. Well, let's hope that that's the only one that works that way. And, oh, here we go. Oh, it's not there. All right. First, I think what to say, and then I speak those words first. Okay, so I'll do it like this. What is it like for a child who to give independent voice to their thoughts must do through, so through a speech generating device? First, I think what to say, then I input the words into my device. Once I have constructed my message, I push speak so that I can speak those words out loud. Merleau-Ponty tells us when we speak, we do not think of speaking. Rather, if anything, we think of what we are saying. We must, in fact, stop picturing the code or even the message to ourselves and make ourselves sheer operators of the spoken word. While this rings true for those of us who speak with our natural voice, it hardly seems the case for people who speak with a machine. When one speaks with or through a device, there are many unique demands that one encounters in the experience. There are the cognitive demands, memory, attention, visual scanning that using the device demands. Let's listen to Jane's experience. No, it's not working. Oh my goodness, what is going on? Well, it's not going to work. Okay, sorry. That year when I got my first talking device, which was called a touch talker, my therapist, Chris, came to school to teach me MinSpeak. I feel that Chris did a great job of teaching me where the icons were and what they meant. She did not teach me how to express myself with it. For example, one particular day I was sent out of the classroom for drooling, but I really had just sneezed out some muffin. For the life of me, I couldn't find the words to say that I had just sneezed. Jane's recollection made me as much a story of abuse as a story of not being able to find the words to say on her new device. And it may be important for us to consider both together. The expressive language skills of children who use speech generating devices are often restricted by the factors that are out of their control. What these children can express at any one time is largely dependent upon the accessibility of their system and on the specific vocabulary that is available to them. Despite her physically being able to push the buttons, the cognitive demands of recalling where the words to say "I just sneezed" were remained beyond her reach. Not being able to find our words may be something that we can all recognize. "It's on the tip of my tongue," we might say, but seldom are we really silenced by our speech. Instead, we find other words to express ourselves. Not so for Jane. She is left silent, searching, and vulnerable, without words that one can express on one's own. Can a child ever really be safe? And even if one can manage the cognitive demands, the demands of a voice that is machine can still leave one silent. I'm not even going to try this speech thing. I am chatting with Gabby, and the alarms go off on her device telling me that her voice is going to die. My voice is running out of gas. There's a gas meter that do, you can't shut it off. I'm trying to talk, but my body is spazzing out on me. It's a race between me and my battery.
Kathy, it was suggested by someone that you have to enable sound when sharing in your PowerPoint. That might enable that.
Well, I will try. I've never had enable sound while sharing my PowerPoint before. I would love to do that because otherwise you guys just will not hear. It's just so much better when this comes from their voices. Now, can you hear? Hang on a minute. Let's see if you can hear this. No. And can somebody tell me where I do that? Because I've never had to do that before. Oh,
That's a great question.
I'll just keep reading them because otherwise, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry. It is so much better when you hear their actual voices, but okay.
We understand. Don't worry.
Technology.
Yeah.
Yeah. You see what the device demands. It's everywhere. Too tired to talk. A feeling that we may all have once in a while. Hey, Joe. Or perhaps we have been talking. Joe, is it you that has the solution?
If you click your share screen at the bottom where you see your screens that you would click. To click your slides, at the very bottom left, it should have a little checkbox that says share sound. No? Oh.
Nope.
Okay, then I got nothing. Sorry.
Thanks for the good try, my friend. Thanks for the good try. All right. So just imagine that isn't my voice saying these. So sorry about that. All right. So too tired to talk, a feeling that we may all have once in a while, or perhaps we may have been talking so much or so loud that our voice is sore. We are worn out, we might say. My voice is running out of gas, but I am running out of gas. But imagine being Gabby in the middle of the conversation. Her voice is going to die, and it announces it to the world in a most annoying way. The device sounds the alarm. Do, 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 do. How strange this might seem to her communication partner. How disruptive. I am running out of gas. You must plug me in soon or I will no longer speak for you, says the machine. In response, Gabby enters a race with the machine, a race that sends her body and very likely her mind into a spasm. The spasm in turn takes precious energy and time, time that Gabby does not have if she's going to say what she wants to say before the announcement that her time to talk is running out. Speech generating devices today have long lasting batteries, batteries that are meant to last through a day's conversation. But yet for a myriad of reasons, they may not. Perhaps someone forgot to plug it in last night. Perhaps it's a day where Gabby has been particularly chatty, or perhaps it's a day that she's been texting all day with her friends across the room. Whatever the reason, the machine demands to be plugged in to find somewhere to get energy. And then there are the physical demands. While speech generating devices bypass some of the physical demands of speech, articulating it through our own breathing and voice systems, they impose others. Accessing the message one wants to speak with a body that is unruly and perhaps inconsistent in its ability to move can prove demanding indeed. This feat may also require other technologies to ask the device to speak. The time that I hate most is at night when I'm out of my chair. When I'm out of my chair, I can't use my device, which means I can't talk. And it means I can't even text my friends. I know my friends are all texting each other and making plans. I can keep up with the chat when I have my device, but not when I'm out of my chair. As human beings, we talk. We talk in bed. We talk laying on a lounge chair beside the pool. We chat as we talk. We may take the ability to speak utterly for granted. But for Gabby, the ability to talk is only granted when she is in her chair with her switches by her head and her device placed in front of her. Her device demands that she use her switches demand that she sit in her chair. As her friends are madly texting under the covers about what will happen tomorrow and the gossip of the day, Gabby is left out, not by her friends, but by the demands of the machine. And then there are professional demands, or at least expectations made and had by professionals. My speech therapist wants me to use my voice. My other speech therapist wants me to use my device. What am I supposed to do? The demand to be used. Consider Donna's story. When I first got my new talker, I only used it for small words and beginning words. That seemed to help people understand what I was trying to say with my voice. I wanted to use my voice, but my speech teacher and my teacher wanted me to use my talker. So I kept trying. I kept trying to use my talker more and more, but it was so hard. My fingers sometimes didn't reach the talker or reach the letter I wanted. It seemed the harder I tried, the stiffer my fingers got. One time my body got so tight that instead of pushing a button, I pushed the whole thing on the floor. Boy, nobody was happy about that. I thought, good, maybe they won't trust me with this thing anymore and I can go back to using my voice. But nope, my teacher said, Donna, you just keep trying. You won't get the hang of it overnight. Well, it turns out I didn't have a choice. Oh, it didn't matter. My teachers weren't happy when I tried to talk instead of using my device. Sometimes they wouldn't even listen to me unless I used my talker. I even had to type out yes and no. That was really weird because I've been saying yes and no for years to communicate through the 20 questions game. Now I had to type it in. Funny, I thought. They told my mom that this is going to help me communicate, not shut me up. To demand that the device be used, to be used even when there's another way. In one way, we may understand this as a language teacher in Canada, where we are. In French class, we are encouraged, one might say, or even demanded to speak French. Using our native language of English was frowned upon. How are we to use French, learn French if we always reverted to English? But for Donna, this is somehow a different experience. The device was supposed to let her voice be heard, her voice, not just the voice of the machine. For Donna, the presence of the device demanded that she abandon her more efficient means of communication, the use of her natural voice, her natural means of expressing, agreeing or disagreeing, her yes, no. Now, one might suggest that it was the device that silenced, it was not the device that silenced Donna, but her teacher. The teacher was making the demand for her to use it exclusively. Yes, yet is that so? It was the presence of the device in Donna's life, the presence of something that she and her family likely worked very hard to acquire, that changed her communicative abilities. In many ways, she was letting her express herself to others as she gave them cues as to what she was saying with her voice. Something that we've come to know in the field is augmenting her natural speech. The device let her be understood by others. Yet ironically, while the device gave her more options for audible expression, Donna's experience was not that. Donna's experience was that of being silenced. The first time I spoke with Dylan was via Skype. I was shocked to see that he was using what I had considered an old-fashioned communication system. He was pointing to a communication display and his assistant was voicing the words so that I could hear them. I was so taken back by Dylan's using of a non-electronic system that I actually forgot to ask him, what is it like? Instead, I peppered him with, well, have you tried? Have you tried this? Have you tried an iPad? He placated me for a while, and then he said he would send me a story that would explain his choice. This is the story that I received that later that day via email. I was presenting at a conference. I received an award, so you could say I was probably a bit more high profile than most participants. My brother acted as my attendant and echoed for me as I spelled out answers to the questions that were being asked of me. Many of the new people I met at the conference were quick to give their opinion on other technologies and approaches that would work better for me. So many of these people never even took the time to listen to my journey with the extensive things that I have tried. In nearly all cases, their suggestion was something that I had already tried. It also seemed that only high-tech solutions were valued. Many of these people made me feel that I was a failure because I was still using low-tech approach. There was more than one person who commented that I hoped I would get a more independent and get a computer technology to respond to their questions rather than having my brother as a facilitator. What they didn't know, and I admit to not being bothered to tell them, that I was deliberately using the low-tech facilitation so that I could quickly meet and respond to people's questions. My voice output technology is so slow that it would have taken me forever to respond. It was so frustrating. The constant and pervasive demands of time. Talking to people with an assistive device is not easy. Consider Rebecca's experience at school with her device. I was in grade 7 when I got my device. I was so excited. But as I got to school and tried to talk to my friends, I just couldn't get the words out fast enough. I'm not a slow thinker, but with my new device, I am a slow talker. At first, my friends waited to hear what I had to say, but after a couple of sentences, they lost interest and had moved on to something else. I was always behind or always waiting, sorry, making them just wait for me. Most of the time when I got out what I wanted to say, it really didn't make any sense anymore because they were three topics ahead of me already. So after a few times of that, I pretty much just stopped talking. Talking on the with a device puts you on the banks of a fast-flowing river, watching a stream of conversation flows by. It may also make the people moving effortlessly through that flow of conversation uncomfortable or anxious as they recognize that you are not one of them. The irony of this experience is remarkable. The very thing that the machine provides, the connection by a human voice, it also seems to deny the free-flowing ease of human vocal interaction. Oh, sorry. It was the first day of school and the first day that Jamie was in my class. Of course, I had seen him wheeling around the school before. I had even been at the assembly where he spoke with his communication device. I remember thinking, cool, just like Stephen Hawking. And I had read the speech in the OT report, which told me about how he used his communication device. I'd even done a bit of homework and read some studies, which said that with technology, students with disabilities can participate and show what they know. I felt fairly confident about this as I read these studies and thought of the times that I'd heard Jamie give speeches. And now the day had come. Jamie was wheeling in my door. Good morning, Jamie, I said. Welcome to room 10. Jamie looked down at his device and pushed some buttons. Beep. Beep, beep, thanks. Come in and find a desk, I said, realizing after I'd said it that he had his tray on his wheelchair and probably didn't really need a desk. He looked down at his device again. Beep, 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 okay. His assistant had just come in and said, I will need a space too. Okay, I said, looking around the room, which suddenly seemed much smaller. In the background, I could hear the beep, beep, beep of Jamie's device. How about over here? Mike, you want to sit by Mike? I asked, and his aide said, Mike and Jamie usually sit together. Beep, beep, not. You don't want to sit by Mike. His aide looked at me and shrugged her shoulders. Beep, beep, beep. Jamie was still looking down at his device. Here, he said. And as if on cue, the bell rang and the rest of the kids started coming in. Hi, Miss M. Hey, Miss M. Aren't you glad to have me again this year? Joe, you're in this class. Hey, that's sick. Megan, come sit over here. Behind the voices of the kids excitedly dialing in, I could still hear the beep, beep, beep of Jamie working away on his device. Jamie, I said, maybe for today you can just sit here by the door. Mike will probably be here soon. He continued to look down at his device, seemingly not even noticing that I had just spoken. The kids were all here now, and the room was so full of their excited voices that I could no longer even really hear if he was trying to say anything. It was time for me to impose some order. Okay, guys, quiet down, I said. And as they did so, I heard Jamie, beep, beep, beep. Sick, he said. Ha, I thought that's great. He's even up to date on the lingo. Then his aide, who was also looking down at his device over his shoulder, said, oh, did you guys talk last night? Now I was really confused. Jamie was still looking down. Beep, beep, beep. Mike not here today. He is sick. Wow. This is going to be a little more complicated than I thought. The beginning of every school year brings teachers into contact with new students, children that they may know nothing about, and some that have come to them with at least some measure of their story already told. And each year, teachers attempt to make contact with these students, to reach them, and to teach them as they are in their care. But how is a teacher to understand how to make contact with a child whose means of expression is so unfamiliar to our own? So much of making contact, building relationship in our human world, is mediated through speech. As was the case for Ms. M, many people know of these technologies, speech-generating devices, through their encounters or their hearing of Dr. Stephen Hawking, the eminent physicist. Dr. Hawking used a speech-generating communication device for over 30 years. During that time, he'd made several appearances, the most recent of which was his cameo appearance on the popular television show The Big Bang Theory. In this spot, Sheldon, one of the main characters in the show, and a devout Stephen Hawking groupie, gets the opportunity to meet the physicist and discuss his dissertation with him. The conversation, while not quite normal, in that before each utterance Dr. Hawking makes with his speech generating device, there's a beep, beep, which tells us that he's doing something with it, and his computerized voice is without the richness and tone of a natural voice, is otherwise unremarkable. Sheldon and Dr. Hawking converse back and forth in much the same way that any budding scholar and distinguished researcher might, with bits of humor thrown in because it is a situation comedy. Having seen this familiar conversation flow enabled by Dr. Hawking's use of a speech generating communication device, it is perhaps no wonder that Miss M expects that Jamie will be able to converse in much the same way. What Miss M and the rest of us watching Big Bang Theory or listening to Dr. Hawking give lectures with his speech generating device are not privy to in these instances is the reality of what such a conversation would entail. These productions are scripted and edited. What is really like is so very different. Yet it is this view that so many of us are privy to. It is no wonder that Miss M is surprised with the reality in which she and Jamie find themselves. Miss M had also heard Jamie speak at assemblies and around the school. What Miss M could not have reasonably understood in those instances was that Jamie, like Stephen Hawking, was delivering a pre-programmed speech. The time and the effort it took him to program the words into his device so that he could deliver them with relative ease and reasonable timing was hidden from view. Jamie's speeches at assembly were far more akin to a child reading a speech out loud to their class than delivering a rehearsed talk from memory. And they were certainly far from just wheeling to the front and addressing the school off the cuff, as they say. Finally, we might ask what demands are made of the voice of the machine. This one I really wish we could hear the proper voice, but sorry. One time I tried to use my device to call Handy Bus. I called them and somebody picked up the phone at Handy Bus. I said I wanted to be picked up this Friday at 1:30. My address is 3453 Apple Way. The Handy Bus person said, "What do you want?" I repeated my message. "I want to be picked up this Friday at 1:30. My address is 3453 Apple Way." The line went dead. Maybe they thought I was a crankpot. I don't know. Anyway, I thought, okay, that didn't work. Next, I guess I will wait until mom comes home and she can call them. I think they will know that she is a real person. That day, Tyler was attempting to do what we may all do on a regular basis, use a phone to request a service. While we may be calling for a taxi or calling for a pizza, when doing so, we may pay attention to why we are calling, what the message is that we want to convey. Our voice announces us, but unless we have a malady, such as a cold or laryngitis, our voice is passed over unnoticed, except to bring us into meaningful contact with the other human being on the line. This is not so for Tyler. For Tyler, the voice got in the way. Today, we may so often hear synthetic speech on the other end of the telephone line. This is so common, in fact, that many of us may be tempted to do to Tyler exactly what was done by the Handy Bus operator, hang up. A computer-generated voice may speak for itself, telling the person on the other end that there's really no one present on the call, but rather a robocall or a computer, and that the message is not in real time from a presently connected person, but recorded so as to make a marketing or a general information call, so that we too decide within seconds of hearing that voice that we are not interested in listening. We are not compelled to listen, as in our minds, there is really no one there that we are in real contact with. So what has happened for Tyler? It seemed that with the voice from the machine, he cannot be heard. In attempting to speak for himself, one might say he has disappeared. His presence as a person is not heard, but rather is stifled by the voice of the machine. The very technology that has allowed him to participate in the world of speaking beings has acted again once to relegate him to silence. He is one might suggest he is once again disabled in this new world of everyday use of computer-generated speech. This is perhaps all the more poignant considering the very people he is attempting to make contact with were those particularly tasked with assisting persons with disabilities. All right, so what? What can we learn from such a phenomenological study, and why is this kind of knowledge or knowing important? I was at a conference in 2012 when I was asked, so what do you do with this kind of study? At first, I was taken back. But then I gave the answer that my professor had given us in class. It's not what you do with phenomenology. It's what phenomenology does to you, changing my practice, questioning assumptions. I began to understand why, despite how wonderful and sometimes even magical speech generating devices can be in the lives of people who are speech impaired, that they are also woefully inadequate. I came to understand why it might be that people like the young woman who told me, people always think that it's high tech is better, and sometimes it is, but for me, this works better, would choose another way. I hate it when people call my device my voice. If my device is broken or not with me, I still want people to communicate and value me. Having a voice is really so much more than the audible voice that is provided by a speech generating device. A voice can be audible, but voice means so much more. Giving voice to one's thoughts, one's opinions, one's desires can be and sometimes should be done in so many ways. I was faced with my belief in technology. I came to question my understanding of technology as being the much sought after solution to the problem of being speech impaired. And in fact, that assumption may be ableist. Were my past views as technology was the solution to disability really just saying to a differently able person that you are not good enough unless you embrace technologies that fix you, that make you normal, that help you talk like a normal person? These devices are so much more than mere tools for talking. In fact, the whole tool paradigm may be questionable. It came clear to me that speech generating devices shape the very life world of people who use them. However, by the careful listening to the words and experience of the voices in my study, I began to understand what it might be like to be shaped by both the affordances and the demands of living in this technologically infused state. I came to wonder if the real goal of technology is not the affordance of independence, but the affordance of connection, to allow us to be connected to each other, to engage with and support each other, to become intertwined with and interdependent upon one another. After all, who is truly independent in our world, and who would really want to be? For now, I will leave you as I began, listening to the voices of students whose devices, who use devices to make their voices heard aloud. We have much to learn about assistive technology, about its power, about its potential, and perhaps most of all, about its dreams deferred, about how much work you and I still have to do to close the gap between its promise and its everyday reality. As I listen, I hear the call to make contact, to close the gap between the promise and the practice. I hear the call to help my students contact their hopes and dreams for active, meaningful, and timely contact in the classroom and ultimately to the world. I hope you may be called upon to listen too. And I know you all are called upon to listen to regularly and generally. So that's it. Are there questions or comments or thoughts? I'm trying to get to the chat, which I can't. I'm going to end this, and I'm going to go this way so I can come back to this computer. Sorry. There. All right. Comments, thoughts, questions.
Thank you very much, Kathy, for such a wonderful presentation. Very, very good thing to remember, that it doesn't always come easy for our children.
Yeah. I see. Hello.
Hi. Hi, Kathy. My name's Melanie. I live in Alberta, and I have a daughter named Ella, who's 7 with Rett syndrome, who uses an AAC device. And yeah, I just found that really interesting and gave me a lot of pause for thought, more about a little bit more about like her daily internal thoughts about using the device. I really liked the example you gave in the classroom with Miss M and how she's further ahead with the kids coming in and doesn't realize he's talking about his friend Mike who's sick, whereas as Ella's communication partner right away I realize, oh, he's talking about his friend Mike who's sick, he's still back there. You know, so yeah, I just think it's really valuable and gave me a lot of things to think about in terms too of like kind of the independence and the always the options of the low tech and high tech and things. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I've actually changed my language about this, and I intentionally talk about electronic communication systems, non-electronic communication systems, because those very words that gather high tech and low tech carry weight, and the device and their backup, but it may not be a backup at all. It might be the exact, truly Dylan, which isn't his real name. He knocked me off my device-centric view of the world. Because I literally did that first time that I talked to him say, oh, have you tried this? Have you tried this? Have you tried this? And I met him. I went and met him. And with him using his non-electronic system, we had the best conversation. We created it together in real time, like most conversations are created. And it wasn't me waiting for him to respond. He pointed, and sometimes I would guess, and if I got it wrong, he would tell me that it was a co-constructed system. And then I realized that he could have used anything. He could have used any system, but he preferred that system. And there's another paper called by adults called I Prefer Communication This Close, which is also talks about that co-construction and that really coming together, that sometimes, and not always, and I've got lots of, this is the demanding device part of, I've got meaning of voice. I've got lots of other talks that gathered around my research that, but sometimes having a screen between breaks a connection rather than creating a connection. So I and that doesn't, you know, all of this is just to think, that's what I say about phenomenology. It's like, is there to make you wonder. It's an odd method for saying this is what should be and this is what shouldn't be. It's, I wonder about that. Or it's a means for questioning and to awaken us to things that we might take for granted in our world. So, yeah. Anyone else have any questions or comments or thoughts? I'll say I'm often met with silence at the end of my talk, so this is not unusual. Yeah, go ahead, whoever.
Yeah, I'll put this in the chat, but aren't today's speech synthesizers much faster? I use Duolingo to study Italian on a phone, and the delay between me saying it and it, the speech coming out is only about 1 second.
Because you're saying it with your voice. The delay comes from the input. Even the fastest typist, even the fastest touch typist is still 10, 15, 20 times slower than what we can articulate with our voice. So you're talking about voice to voice.
But also typing to voice.
Well, it depends on how fast you can type.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's the issue. It depends on, and most of the people that the students that I support aren't going to be touch typists. They're going to be either slower because they have physical challenges, maybe not using a direct select at all, maybe using some kind of alter, and that really slows things up. If you want to read, I have a whole paper on out of time, and I go into the issues of how fast speech is and what the natural delay is between somebody speaking and somebody else responding and those kinds of things. And yeah, today's technology is a million times better than it was.
Well, but what if they use Toby to generate eye pointing to generate the speech?
It depends on, it's still going to be way slower than what natural speech is.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, and we just need to consider that. You know, it doesn't mean that it's not good. It just means that we need to pay attention to and as I said, I mean, really, I think people in my paper, and I can send you the copy of it, my paper on time, is that really our kids speak in text time. So if you were typing back and forth to someone, and if you're a really fast typist, you can put it out there. But if you're not, if you're a hunt and peck typist, or you're not really, then, you know, you have a delay. So yeah, good point though. Thank you. Jonah,
yeah.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Oh, good. Because we got a little bit of a blizzard going on here. So I keep blipping out. So I apologize if I
Where are off. You? Where are you?
I was just about to say I'm from Manitoba. Okay. And I'm a resource teacher at a school in Manitoba. And I have a student who lives with Rhett. And she is absolutely amazing. And I just wanted to share a couple things about this young lady. She has taught so many of the employees in the building that she comes to school at about using AAC. And I'm very cautious about saying technology, like you said, because she sometimes uses technology spontaneously, but it's not all the time. She lives with apraxia. So sometimes the delay to get to what she wants to say is great. And so it's been a real educational piece for us to learn to wait and wait some more and be detectives and watch for, as you guys know, AAC is everything. So watching her body language and watching her eyes are always telling us yes or no. Her facial expressions are telling us what she wants and what she doesn't want. And where we saw this student explode with AAC, like explode, was as soon as we had students buy in. When her classmates and her friends bought in and we had an AAC board games club across the board game, the smiles, the interaction, she was like saying, hey, you guys speak my language. You're cool with, you know, kid language, not my language. So if there's any parents watching, what I wanted to say was try so hard to get those other kids to buy in, because peers are way better teachers than we are. The peers are the best way to get kids hooked in and make sure wherever your child is, that there is AAC available everywhere, that there's core boards on the walls, in the bathroom, that there's, I need help, I need breaks, because technology dies. It always dies when I need it the most. And I can't imagine my student, for example, if she needed to use the washroom and the technology is dead, then what?
Bravo.
So I just want to say,
Jonah, I just want to say I'm coming to Manitoba, or virtually, I was supposed to come to Manitoba to give a talk, and my talk is on creating accessible AAC environments, and you're nailing some of the very pieces that are absolutely critical to that. The other piece, I'm going to just share an anecdote about a young lady who has a non-electronic pod system in her classroom, and the kids, and it happens to be an inclusive classroom on a colony school. And so she's learned to use the non-electronic system. All the other kids go in and can learn to use a non-electronic system with her. And I asked these kids, this is one of my favorites. I asked them, so how many languages do you speak? And they say, we speak 5 languages. And I said, oh, tell me. We speak High German at church, we speak Low German at home, we speak English at school, and we speak pod, and we speak sign. And that is a a communicatively accessible classroom. Because and you're right. And I've taken non-electronic systems in because here's the other thing. It's not one or the other. I've taken non-electronic systems in to speak with young girls with Rett. And when I start talking to them with their language, with their representation of language, completely light up. Somebody is speaking the way I speak. And I think that's a really important thing. And I, if it was another one of my talks, not this, if it was another one of the themes that came up, that definitely would come up. So I'm glad you raised that, that really we need to create a community of speakers who can scaffold and support, just like kids who are mouth talkers. It's a silly way to say it, but that's the way that I've come to say it, grow up being scaffolded by all kinds of people who also are speaking with their mouths. Our kids don't typically grow up in that kind of environment. So the much more that we can put that kind of environment together, and you're right, kids will get it way faster than any old adults will. So thank you for sharing that. And I couldn't agree more.
Sorry, could I say one more thing about the learning?
Sure.
So the students that you were talking about, they were talking about the beep, beep, beep and the annoyance and the humor is fun. I was trying not to laugh. I was laughing out loud, but you couldn't hear me, of course. And again, talking about technology, if our student did not have access to all of the other AAC, she would not be able to demonstrate for us her learning, specifically with her apraxia. And giving her the opportunity, a simple yes and no button is like brilliant. Never mind.
Have you ever tried to talk to anybody by only answering yes or no questions?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay,
We do it in games to demonstrate to kids how difficult it is for our student with the yes and no. Yes and no is only one tiny piece of all of what we have. It's one tiny piece. But what I'm saying is to have that available also, because our student will look with her eyes and she'll look at, yeah, no, get lost. We have something else. We have emotional charts. We have her Skyle. We have her iPad. So we have a plethora of things, but our student would not be able to share her learning, her grade 8 learning, if she didn't have all of that available to her all the time.
Multimodal communication is the key. Multimodal communication is the key. Absolutely.
Thanks for sharing today.
Yeah, no worries. Not my stories, really. Other kids' stories. But I'm happy that hopefully that they made some people wonder and think. And thank you for sharing your success story. That's wonderful.
Go ahead.
I wanted to thank you, Kathy. We're out in Vancouver with our daughter, Dina, who's 40 years old. 42.
Yeah. Very nice.
And got her
with
Toby.
Rett syndrome.
With Rett syndrome, of course, yes. And so I have a lot of questions. First of all, I'd like to say to Jonah that you're hired. If you'd like to come and live with us, we'll be happy to take you on in our home and with Dina in her home, because you are a very special lady. I'm also a teacher, and I'm certainly not as creative as you are. And you understand a lot of things that have taken us years to understand that many people still don't understand. So you're very special, and I thank you on behalf of your student that she's so lucky to have you. Kathy, thank you for speaking with us. I would like to know how I can get a hold of your papers and so on that we might learn some more.
I'll put my email in the chat, and anyone who wants can email me, and I'm happy to share papers. I've written a few chapters in books and a few papers. And I will be giving some other talks. One of the talks that I give that might be out there somewhere is The Meaning of Voice, which is if you send me an email, I'm happy to respond.
Okay. Have you heard very much? I have many questions and I don't want to take this over, so I am not quite sure what to do. Do you think that it's desirable on the part of the user to be able to be to try for us to have her catch her voice so that her machine can start to use her voice?
You mean her actual audible voice?
Yeah.
Oh boy. There's technology to do that today with just, and I've actually met a few people who their focus is that. The voice, well, first of all, it will cost you about $2,000 for that voice. And the ones that I've heard that are artificially created from a small sample of voice really have a ways to go yet. Have you heard a voice that, because when you're thinking about synthetic speech that comes the way, you know, on what they've done is they've sampled from a wide range of speech, like lots of speech. What they're doing now is they're taking one sample and then using another sample to put it upon. So it can work, but I'm not sure it's going to be as understandable as some of the current voices that are out there. I'll give you a little glimpse into one of the things that I do share in my Meaning of Voice talk that I've heard from mostly young ladies, but they all tend to have come with the same voice. And I go, well, you know, because there's lots of voices to choose from. And you can modify them. And they say, well, the reason that I use this voice is because people can understand me. And when I go and use some kind of other fancy voice or more, if I tweak the voices, people are not as likely to be able to understand the synthetic speech. Now, the synthetic speech of today is, oh my, like I've been doing this for 40 years it's interesting. Your daughter could have been one of my early students when I didn't know anything, unfortunately. And what you're saying about, if I only knew then what I know now, oh my goodness, how different my practice would have been. But I would say you could try that, but it's been my experience that people still tend to go back to the voices that are created from a rich sample, because even though they still don't have the intonation and the expression that we can give with our natural voices, they are worked upon. Highly worked upon. So maybe in 10 years that will really be something. I met Rupa Patel at Isaac the last time we were able to actually get together. Isaac is the International Society for Augmentative and Alternative Communication. And I know that what she's done is amazing, but I still think there's a ways to go. And again, as I said, the most important thing is to be understood. Right.
Yeah. Well, so we are very happy with every new thing that comes out because I guess I was really the only one I could see with her eyes that she was always following conversations. And when she was born in her first pictures, you could see when she was, you know, the listening and so on. Yeah. But she's starting to use the predictive spelling, and we're working with someone you probably know from Alberta, Alex Delanuez. Do you know her?
I don't know her, no.
Well, she is a speech therapist and is not working directly with Dina, but is working with us and our three companions that we have for Dina, who are all in at the university. And it is really amazing how much Dina is finding and doing, and even with predictive spelling. So I don't know how much I want to push. I've been pushing for 42 years, and I don't know how much I should be pushing. But anyway, I'll drop you a line.
You be a mama bear. That's your job, to be a mama bear. That's your job. And I just want to follow up with you to say that probably the most important thing that we can teach children or adults who have complex communication needs, who can't get their requirements met through their audible voices, is to spell. because it doesn't, you'll never have all the words that you want on any device.
No, she is starting to spell with the predictive spelling.
She's
doing the word wall. That's where Alex wanted to start to see, I guess, what she thinks.
Sure. And I'll just put in a little plug here. There is a certificate at the University of Alberta for teaching students with complex communication needs that I know at least one person in the audience has participated in. And so we're working hard at helping to create more awareness of how to create accessible classroom environments that Jonah was talking about, how to create the opportunities for effective and engaging learning and participation, and certainly literacy is part of that. So,
I'd like to add to what my wife was saying. With Dina being 42 years old and in very good shape, thank goodness, with Rett syndrome. Just a bit of history that you might like to hear, since you go back 40 years. We took Dina 40 years ago to Seattle, Washington, and she sat on Dr. Rett's lap.
Oh, wow.
And Dr. Rett looked at her eyeballs, looked at her right straight in her eyes and said, "Little girl, you will speak with your eyes."
Bravo.
That was before we had any computers. And then we came home and we worked with Rosemary Parks, who you probably know. Rosemary is a eminent speech therapist or communication therapist that Dina worked with for years. And we're still doing this. And the university companions that we have from Simon Fraser University and UBC, these young women are so turned on with sitting with Dina and communicating with her and reading National Geographic stories and getting Dina's impression of this and crash courses and like studying in university with her. It's so amazing what Dina is learning and how she can communicate her thoughts. Yes, that what Jonah said, the apraxia is the elephant in the room, and you've got to give Dina time. You cannot rush a little girl with Rett syndrome or an adult with Rett syndrome. They need to think about it. They need to figure out what's going on, and then they'll express themselves somehow. And again, whether you call it low tech or high tech, I have to say that every way of communicating, whether it's an eye blink or looking away or a smile or putting your hands to your mouth with pleasure, as if, yes, 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 I like this, carry on, let's do more. There's so many ways that these girls communicate. You have to pay attention. And these women that come from the universities that have the chance to work with our daughter are so thrilled with what they've learned. You know, they're going out in the real world, becoming lawyers and doctors and nurses and occupational therapists. But what they learned from Dina and our family is so amazing. It's so amazing. They're so thrilled with how they can communicate. They never thought they would have a situation of learning from a nonverbal person, somebody teaching them how to really communicate. So I want everybody to realize, if you're younger than we are, never give up on your daughters. Keep working. And this school teacher from Manitoba, Jonah, you're terrific. My family's from Winnipeg, and I can see what you're doing in the cold, cold. You're just communicating and having fun. Keep doing it. Never give up.
That's marvelous. And I totally concur. And actually, it's interesting, I'm teaching a class right now on the ethics of inclusion, and one of the key messages in that class is that we all need to learn with and from people with significant disabilities, because they like your daughter, they have much to teach us. So thank you.
So I have a last question for you. Is it possible for somebody as young as I am to take any kind of courses that would help me teach my companions? They're not the employees from the home where Dina lives that do the toileting and the bathing and the feeding and so on. These are students that come and work with her. And she's doing astronomy and astrology, and she is saying, "I understand, I don't understand. I have a question.
Toby has been totally programmed by these students. Our Toby machine is fantastic because of their programming. Students are amazing.
I would like to know how
you're a teacher.
Yes.
So you have a bachelor degree.
Yes, and I finished the test.
Anyway, I'm just going to say the certificate, and that's what I know right now, is open to anyone as a post baccalaureate.
Okay.
So send me an email. I'll send you some information. And oh, I'd love to have you in the certificate. You would enrich us greatly. So awesome.
She's enriched me a lot, I can tell you.
I can tell. Yeah, you're a lucky man. Don't forget it.
Christine, I'd like to thank you as well for setting this up for us.
Thank you. I can't take all the credit. It was all the presidents across Canada have pitched in both financially and to organize this all. And actually, in the interest of time, we do have to sign off. So I would like to just give one more shout out to all the associations that have worked so hard. Ontario Rett Syndrome Association, Saskatchewan Rett Syndrome Association, Manitoba Rett Syndrome Association, the Rett Syndrome Society of Alberta, and the Rett Syndrome Society of British Columbia. Thank you all for all your hard work, for putting this on for our families. And we really look forward to providing more throughout the next month. So thank you. Thank you so much, Kathy, for joining us today and enlightening us with your very inspirational information and teaching us today. We really appreciate your efforts.
Go out and do great things with kids. I know you will.
So. Thank you.
Okay.